I'm happy to be with you again today. So I talked about it yesterday. We were going to talk about weight control. It seems to be one of the more prevalent topics today. Now this was, let's see. I don't know if you can see the slides. Yeah, they're coming up. Okay, my wife sent me this. Thought you might enjoy it. Anyway, weight control. Many people ask, you know, what causes people to be too heavy? And the common concept is, well, it's either too little exercise, too few calories out, or too many calories in. We're going to find out about, actually, there is a group who has the same activity level as the American office worker. Same activity level, but they weigh 20% less. So they thought, well, if the activity is the same and they weigh 20% less, it must be because they're starving them. But when they measured the calories, they were eating 30% more calories. So would you like to know what their secret is? Okay, stay tuned. We're going to get there. Okay. So how is obesity defined? It's actually defined by the body mass index. It's your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. This compensates for people of different heights. A normal weight or healthy weight is BMI of 20 to 25. Overweight is 25 to 30. Obese would be 30 to 40. Morbidly obese would be over 40. If you want to figure out your body mass index, do you have to have a calculator to do it? Actually, no. They have tables. You can get them on the internet. Here's one. You can go across the top and find your weight and then go down to find your height, and you find out that you're too short for your weight. Okay? That's one way to find out what your body mass index is. How big a problem is it in America? It costs our nation about $17 billion a year in the year 2000. One in four adults is obese in America, causes death, or contributes to the death of 300,000 Americans each year, and it's associated with other problems like diabetes, heart disease, and hypertension. In the Framingham study, this was a study done sometime after World War II, they looked at the town of Framingham, and they were looking for risk factors, things that increase your risk of illness, heart attack, strokes, and death. This is where they found that, say, your serum chloride had nothing to do with whether you got a heart attack or not, but your serum cholesterol did. High correlation. This is where we started understanding about risk factors. Risk factors like high blood pressure, increasing your risk of heart attacks and strokes. And they found that obesity was a significant risk factor for premature death, conferred a 50 to 100% increased risk of premature death. Now, who wants to know about your risk factors? In other words, who wants to know if obesity is going to shorten your life or not? Does your doctor want to know? Well, maybe, but it's sort of a kind of a passing interest. Who does it affect financially? What's that? Life insurance, exactly. Now, they won't ask you if you're obese or not. They will just ask you, what's your height, what's your weight, and then they'll calculate your body mass index, and based on that, they know how much to charge you so that they can cover your death benefit when you die. Now, aside from, of course, the health risks, there's social problems. And it's fun. If I was in the hospital, I wanted to talk to a group of nurses. All I had to do was talk to one about weight control, and boom, I certainly had a crowd of nurses there wanting to know about weight control. So what do I tell them? Well, it's been around for a long time. Why the concern now? It's on the increase. Surveys done in 2000, obesity went from, the prevalence went from about 23% in 1994 to 30% in 2000. Here's a graph I usually like to point out, but if you look under 1991, on the West Coast, the light blue, very light blue, that is 10% of the population or less had obesity. On the East Coast, the slightly darker blue was 15% or less. In less than 5 years, the West Coast went from 10 to 15, the East Coast went from 15 to 20, and then in another 2000, the West Coast went from 15 to 20, the East Coast went from 20 to 25%, and then in the little inset on the right lower corner, it jumped another 5% on the West Coast and another 5% on the East Coast. It's on the rise. I took an airplane flight and sat next to a lady who designed airplane seats for airplanes, for commercial airlines, and they had to make them larger because people aren't fitting in the old seats. And Southwestern Airlines got upset at one point, and they said they were going to put their foot down. They said, if you can't fit in one seat, we're going to sell you tickets for two seats. And so I saw this little cartoon, showed this bean pole of a guy, really thin guy, going up to the Southwest ticket agent, and she's saying, no, sir, I can't sell you half a ticket. That's what he wanted. Obesity is a problem. What can we do about it? Well, the newsstands have a new diet every month. And why can they get away with doing this every month? Because last month's diet didn't work. So they have a ready supply of customers to sell their magazines. One example, McCall's 1992 issue showed how Oprah, 2 years earlier, had lost 67 pounds, and all the world rejoiced. And then, when this article came out, she had gained all the weight back, plus then. All were saddened because of this. However, on the next page, there was an interview with Dr. Calloway showing that her failure was predictable. And someone with her resources should have been able to get the counseling to tell her not to do the low-calorie diet because it will cause a rebound effect. And here's a picture of Oprah. Again, the caption reads, slender or starved. The implication is, do you have to be starved to be slender? We want to share, no, you don't. Have low-calorie diets worked in the past? This was a question asked as far back as 1959. Stunkard and McLaren Hume, they did a survey of the previous low-calorie diet studies over the past 30 years. They found only 7 were considered well-designed and well-documented. With the exception of one, a maximum of only 29% of the patients lost 20 pounds or more. Less than 8% lost 40 pounds or more. And they question, it says, why the failure? Why didn't this work? Well, he did his own study to find out. He looked at the next 100 patients coming to the clinic for a low-calorie diet. And they put them on a 800 to 1,500-calorie diet. To get a perspective, a normal intake would be 2,500 to 3,000 calories per day. So this was about a third to half as many calories as you would normally take in. What happened? Well, at the end of treatment up there, you see in the circle there, only 12%, 12 out of 100, lost 20 pounds or more. A large number had dropped out. By the end of 1 year, right under that 12 mark, only 6 were successful in maintaining it. And at the end of 2 years, only 2 out of 100 were able to maintain the weight loss. Why the failure? Well, they noted some problems. They noted nervousness, weakness, irritability, fatigue, and nausea, some of the side effects. One man who had lost the most weight noted increasing tension. He developed an acute schizophrenic reaction, ended up in the hospital, and gradually regained most of the weight that he had lost. Why does a low-calorie diet not work? Well, the reason is because your creator actually has created it to protect you from a low-calorie diet or from starvation. For an example, what's this guy doing? What's that? Push-ups, right. What does that stress in your body? Muscles, right? Triceps and all. Pectoral muscles. It stresses those muscles. After the exercise, what do the muscles do to prepare for the next exercise? If he keeps doing this, what's going to happen to his muscles? They're going to get bigger, right? They're going to get ready for the next exercise session. So your body is adapting to the stress that you put it under. Our God created us that way. It's a wonderful design. Let me ask you this. Does a low-calorie or starvation diet put the body under stress? Yeah, anybody who's tried it knows. It's stressful, but it metabolically, it puts your body under stress. There was a study, they asked the question, well, how does the body adapt to the stress you're putting it under? Well, the Carnegie Nutrition Laboratory did a study in 1919 to find out. They put a group of men on a 1,400-calorie diet. Again, it's about half the normal calories they would take in. And they noticed what happened to the metabolism. The temperature dropped, body heat release dropped, oxygen consumption dropped, pulse rate dropped, and they had decreased energy. What does it mean, decreased energy? Well, it means if I'm on a low-calorie diet and I see a bird out the window, I say, oh, that's an interesting bird. I think I'll get a closer look. And then I think, no, I think I'll watch the bird from here. Okay, you just don't have any energy to do anything above the bare minimum. So the body was turning down its metabolism. It was conserving calories. It was burning calories slower to conserve calories because you're taking in less. It's like if you're trying to conserve energy in a house, you turn the thermostat down, and that's what's happening in your body. There was a second study done at the end of World War II. They wanted to study starvation because they were going to be freeing starvation victims in concentration camps, and they found that if they fed them too fast, they died. When they did further studies, they found that when you feed starvation victims, you change the adenosine triphosphate adenosine diphosphate goes into adenosine triphosphate. It sucks up all the free phosphorus. Phosphorus level goes down. Your heart goes into arrhythmia and you die. So you have to be very careful to watch the phosphorus levels when you're refeeding these people. But that's not what we want to look at. We want to look at what happened during this 6 months starvation period that they put 32 conscientious objectors in to study this. These 32 conscientious objectors were put on a semi-starvation diet for about 6 months. Now, their weight predictably dropped, and that was not unexpected. At the end of the six-month period, their muscle mass, well, their total body weight had dropped to about 75% of normal. Muscle mass had dropped to 60% of normal. Body fat had dropped down to about 33% of normal. That wasn't too unexpected. But what was a little unexpected was what they found when they refed them. If you look at the bottom there, zero, you'll see a zero and then an S12 and an S24. That's the starvation weeks going from left to right. And what you find in the little circled areas there, that's body fat. Now, what you don't see is, the body fat dropped to a minimum at S of 24, starvation 24. At 24 weeks, they refed them. They gave them normal calories again. And what happened was the metabolism rose over the next year, but at the end of the year, it was still below normal. Muscle mass rose toward normal again, but at the end of the year, it was still below normal. But if you look at the little clear circles there, that jumped up. The body fat jumped up, and at 33 weeks was actually 10 pounds above what it was before they started the diet or the fast or the starvation. And at the end of a year, it was still 2 to 3 pounds above what it was before the starvation diet. And they thought, what is going on? Why is this happening? Well, what happened was when the body came off the fast, at S24 on the bottom there, the body says, uh-oh, okay, now we have calories, because they started refeeding them. The body said, we'd better get ready for the next starvation. So how are we going to do that? Well, we'll increase the metabolism a little bit, but we won't keep it as high as it used to be. We'll increase the muscle mass a little bit, but not as much as it used to be, because then we'll have less muscle to feed in the next starvation. And we'll increase the body fat above what it used to be so that we'll have more fat to feed less muscle during the next starvation. And in countries where they have annual starvations, crops run out, they become really like skin and bones. Then when the crops come in, they become obese. Then when crops run out, they become skin and bones. And when crops come in, they become obese. And they just do this cycle to survive those conditions. They did a study with wrestlers. They found that when wrestlers weight cycle, their metabolism drops. What's weight cycling? That's where they starve themselves to make weigh-ins, and then they eat. They starve and they eat, starve and eat. When they do that, the metabolism drops. Do wrestlers want low metabolism? No, of course not. They want a high metabolism. So weight cycling is, again, not a good idea for wrestlers. Women dieters, they looked at women dieters, and they wanted to see how repeated low-calorie diets affected their metabolism. They looked over the past year, and if they had gone on 1,000 calories a day or less for 7 days or more, 4 times over the previous year, the metabolism was a lot less than what it was in those that hadn't. Well, what happens on repeated starvations or low-calorie diets? They did a study to find out how the body adapts. On the right there, that bar, they put, you'll see 1,000 obese patients, and they put them on a low-calorie diet, 600 to 800 calories a day. And the bar on the right shows that the first time they did this, they lost 0.19 kilograms per day. That was the rate at which they were losing weight. Then they came off the diet, and they gained all the weight back, plus an extra 20%. That was the weight rebound, which we understand why that would have happened. So they said, no problem. We'll just do the diet again. So on the bar on the right is their second trial. But this time, under the same conditions, they only lost 0.15 kilograms per day. I thought, how come they're losing weight at a slower rate? So they thought, well, maybe they're cheating. Maybe they're not following the diet at home. So we'll put them in the hospital. So they put them in the hospital, and sure enough, first time they did it, on the blue bar on the right, you see that they lost 0.47 kilograms per day. Very fast rate of weight loss. Then they came off the diet, they gained all the weight back plus another 15%, so they had the weight rebound, and they said, no problem, we'll just put them back in the hospital. But the second time they put them back in the hospital, they only lost 0.37 kilograms per day. They were losing weight at a slower rate. They said, how come? What's going on? Well, what was going on is the first time this happened, the first time they had the low-calorie diet, the body says, we're not getting in as many calories today. I wonder if this is a pattern. And sure enough, after a couple of days, the body says, this is a pattern. We better turn down the metabolism to conserve calories. And so everything slows down. That's the protective response to protect you from the starvation. When they came off the diet, of course, the body says, okay, we better get ready for the next starvation. So they gained all the weight back, plus some. The second time it happened, the body says, we're not getting as many calories today. I wonder if this is a pattern. And says, I'm not going to wait to see if this is a pattern. We've learned our lesson. We're going to turn down the metabolism today, immediately. It responds much more aggressively and conserves calories much more efficiently. The second time around, the body is being trained to protect you from the starvation. And that's why people going on a low-calorie diet can lose 10 pounds the first time they try it. Next time they try it, maybe only 5-pound loss. Next time, only 2 or 3-pound loss. And they get frustrated, and they don't understand why this isn't working like it used to work. And this is why your body is adapting. So what have we seen so far? Low-calorie diets don't work, and they cause a weight gain in the long run. They're tolerated poorly. It slows your metabolism, so you're not going to have the energy that the Holy Spirit's wanting, the energy to do the things the Holy Spirit's calling you to do. It'll produce a weight rebound when you come off the low-calorie diet. And on repetition, you'll have a slower rate of weight loss. Okay, so this is a very difficult concept to get across to patients because the natural tendency is, oh, I'm gaining weight, I got to cut down on my calories. And when they do that, they're setting themselves up for a weight rebound. I will tell this to patients, they'll come in one time, then I'll see them 3 months later, and they're still trying the low-calorie diet. So it's a very difficult thing to re-educate on, but it's important if they want to be successful. Okay, has anyone heard about Atkins diet? Okay, some of you have. What is it? Does it work? Is it safe? Actually, it's not new. It was introduced in the 1860s by William Banting. Its effectiveness and safety are still questioned. In 2004, the food industry began to capitalize on the low-carb craze by selling these low-carb options. What is a low-carb option? Well, I remember my wife asked me to pick up something in a health food store on the way home, and it was lunchtime. I'd missed lunch, and so on the way out, I said, oh, I'll get some of these health bars. They're always good, so I got a couple of those for lunch, and went in the car, and I took a bite out of one, and I said, yuck, what is this? This tastes like straw. And I read the label, oh, this is a low-carb option. Okay, now that was my introduction to low-carb options. What is a low-carb diet? Actually, there's no definition of a low-carb diet, but the new Food and Nutrition Board has established a minimum requirement for carbohydrates. Because your brain and your spinal cord, your nervous system can only burn sugar, you need about 130 grams of carbohydrates a day to supply your nervous system. Also, just to get the nutrients you need, those nutrients come with carbohydrates. And so if you're getting the carbohydrates from plants, you'll get the nutrients you need to protect you from degenerative diseases. And so they say you need 225 to 325 grams of carbohydrates per day for that. Now, the meat and the dairy, those are the high-protein, high-fat foods that are very low in carbohydrates. Those don't have the nutrients that you need, and they also don't have the carbohydrates you need, and so that's why they're saying you need these carbohydrates. If you're getting the carbohydrates, then you'll be pretty much assured of getting the nutrients with those. What does the Atkins diet allow? Does it meet either of those requirements? No. They start out at getting 20 grams of carbohydrates per day and then slowly increasing it to a maximum of 60 grams per day, which meets neither of those recommendations. Does the Atkins diet work? Does it cause weight loss? Because people are willing to risk the nutrient deficiency if it can get rid of their weight. There is a weight loss initially. And the question is why, and then also does it last? They did a study to find out why the weight loss. And what they observed is the people that were taking the Atkins diet, when they measured the calories intake, they were only getting 66% of the calories they would normally eat. And so they asked them, why aren't you eating 100% of the calories you would normally eat? They say, well, we have no appetite for the foods that are available on this diet. So they thought, oh, well, and after eating those low-carb bars, I understood why. Okay, So they thought, well, maybe the Atkins program is working because of decreased calorie intake because of suppressed appetite for the foods that are available. So they said, well, let's test this. So they had two groups of patients. They had one group of patients, okay, you're on the Atkins group, or low, the low-carb group, And you can have as many calories as you want, but you can only have so many carbohydrates. They limited their carbohydrates to 20 grams per day for about 6 weeks. Well, and when they ate their foods, they were only eating 66% of the calories as expected. The other group, they said, okay, you can have as many carbohydrates as you want, but your total calories has to match the Atkins group. So they were limiting their calories. So the calorie intake was the same in both groups. But one group was getting their calories from protein and fat. The other group was getting their calories from carbohydrates, mainly. And when they looked at them at the end of 6 weeks, both groups lost 11 pounds. From this and several other studies, they found that they had actually two extensive reviews, five more recent studies, showed that the Atkins diet works by suppressed appetite for the foods that are available. It's essentially a variation of a low-calorie diet. What's going to happen then when you come off this Atkins program? You're going to get the weight rebound that you get with any low-calorie diet. That's the problem. Let's see if I got... Okay. Is the diet risky? Well, yeah. In order to get the Atkins diet, you have to have high protein, high fat. Where do you get protein and fat without carbohydrates? It's mainly the animal products, the meat and the dairy. And when you do that, you're going to increase your cholesterol level. That's the LDL, the bad cholesterol, and that rose significantly on the Atkins diet. There's also a risk of vitamin and mineral deficiencies because the meat and the dairy don't have all the minerals and vitamins and phytochemicals and nutrients you need, and so you're required on the Atkins program to take in minerals and vitamins to supplement that because you're not getting them. If you don't take them, they've had actually people die of the program because they're not getting the nutrients. There is a high dropout rate in the Atkins group. How come? Well, weakness was a common symptom. Why are they weak? Well, they're only getting 66% of the calories they would normally get. Constipation. Why are they constipated? Well, they got they're from animal products, meat and dairy. There's no fiber in those, and so you're going to have a low-fiber diet, which causes constipation. They also had bad breath. That's halitosis, muscle cramps, diarrhea, rashes. And you had to have vitamins and minerals, supplements, and there's a high dropout rate. And there was a very... the average weight loss after a year or two was very low, not just a few pounds. Has anyone heard of Weight Watchers? Yeah, it's publicized and it's promoted. I mean, everywhere. It's you go into shopping centers and they'll have a Weight Watchers center there. What is it? It's similar to a low calorie diet. You have points for calories. You also have points for fat. And limiting the fat's not a bad idea, but again, it's based on low-calorie diet, and because of that, it has the same problems any low-calorie diet has. They did a 2-year randomized controlled trial, and the average weight loss after 2 years was only 6.4 pounds, which is, well, for most people that are trying to lose weight, that's not enough, anywhere near enough. Only 16% maintained and achieved and maintained a weight of weight loss of 10% or more. So again, not to be promoted. Low-calorie diets. So what have we seen so far? Low-calorie diets don't work. Low-carb diets don't work. Okay, so what are some things that help? Well, I'm going to talk about some things that will contribute to weight loss, and then I'm going to talk about the core issue of obesity in America. What is actually causing the epidemic? Does when we eat make a difference? Actually, yes. Eating the main meal in the morning rather than the evening decreases weight. The calories that you take in the morning tend to be burned. The calories you take in at night tend to be stored. So if you're eating the same number of calories but shift when you eat them, shift it to the morning, you can actually lose weight. Many people that are trying to lose weight will go on a two-meal-a-day plan. They'll eat biggest meal at breakfast, moderate meal at lunch, and then they may even skip the evening meal. We're not cutting the total daily calories down, just shifting when you're taking them in. In America, I think the tradition is what is the meal that we will typically skip when we're pressed for time?
Breakfast,
okay. What is typically the largest meal we eat? Be dinner. That's the evening meal. And that's the tradition. And again, many traditions in America set us up for failures. Okay. Is exercise the answer? Exercise helps, but exercise will bring a weight loss, but then further exercise, you're going to get a plateau. How does it work? Well, look at some, they did some studies with rats, and they put them on a treadmill, and they exercised them daily. And some rats, one group got 0 minutes a day, and then if you look at the bottom there, some rats got 20 minutes a day, some 40 minutes, and some an hour. And if you, I don't know if I can point. I don't know if you can see it there. Oh, okay, the pointer works. Here, the weight dropped every 20 minutes until an hour exercise per day. This is the weight dropped. But going to 2 hours, 3, 4, there's a weight plateau until you get to around 5 or 6 hours, and the weight starts dropping again. What happened out here was the rats went into total exhaustion. They stopped eating. They were breaking their toes in the treadmill. They basically said, I give up, let me die. Okay, so you want to avoid this part of the exercise curve. What you'd like to do is get in the active range, but notice you don't have to be running marathons. Brisk walking can, you know, do this and get you in this zone. So you want to stay out of the sedentary zone into the active zone. They also noted something very interesting with appetite and calorie intake. The calorie intake, what they found is that as the weight dropped, their appetite actually dropped as well. They were taking in less calories until they hit this plateau. And when they hit this plateau, then with further exercise, the calorie intake increased. They wondered, why is that? Why is there an initial calorie drop? Well, the reason is that 75% of the calories you take in are burned just to keep you warm. That's the major energy expenditure in normal people. Only 25% is needed to move, talk, and do all the other functions you have. As the weight dropped, the body surface area shrunk, and they were radiating less heat. There was less body surface area to lose heat with. And that accounted for the initial weight drop, for the initial appetite drop. Once their weight stabilized, that was no longer contributing to their calorie need. So once that plateaued, then the thing that determined their appetite was exercise, and it increased linearly. The more exercise they had, the higher the appetite increased. And that was that that was the explanation for the initial drop. Well, these are rats. Does this work in people? Well, they went to India. Same researchers went to India and to find out. And they looked at a mill. They looked at different mill workers. And they looked at the mill workers and they classified them according to how active they were. These were the least active, the clerks and the office workers. And then another group here were stallholders, and they were a little more active. And then each group was more active until you got the people that shoveled the coal and hauled hauled the grains in, and that these are the most active. Here we see the weight. Again, the weight dropped as activity increased, but then it hit a plateau beyond which there was no further weight loss, just like in the rats. And they didn't get into the exhaustion range like the rats did, and that was good. Okay. Here we see the same thing happened with the appetite. As the weight dropped, the appetite dropped until they hit the weight plateau. Once the weight plateau was reached, the more exercise, the more calories they took in. And that's the normal V that you'd always see with exercise. Okay, so question then, how do I get out of the sedentary range into the active range? And what type of exercise is going to give me the best response? They did a study to find out which was more likely to give a successful weight loss approach. And so they took about 34 patients, and they said, okay, we want you to exercise 30 minutes a day, and then we want you to increase your exercise time 1 minute per day, and then record your weights over, you know, several weeks. And some chose walking, some chose running, some chose swimming, some chose bicycling. What they found was 6 chose jogging. 3 of those dropped out due to injuries. Other 3 could not tolerate it long enough to produce the effect on their weight. 3 chose cycling, 2 chose swimming, but all of these failed to tolerate the exercise long enough to be included in the study, which is a 30-minute minimum. Only 11 of the initial 34 patients were able to maintain their exercise period for over 30 minutes on a consistent basis, and all 11 chose walking. Okay. Now, I'm not saying you can't do these other exercises. It's just if you want the biggest chance of success and you're starting an exercise program, your best chance statistically is going to be walking. Here were the results. They found that, this is kind of a busy picture, but here's the time they exercised. As the exercise time went up, the weight dropped and plateaued. Here we see the exercise time increasing, and here it plateaued. The weight dropped here. Then they increased their exercise time up to 90 minutes. The weight dropped again. Nobody went from 90 to 2 hours, so we're not sure if that further exercise period would make a difference. But I think most people are doing good if they can get 30 minutes in a day. However, they can. There is a possibility of even 90 minutes a day of a brisk walk being effective. Okay, so the question is, well, is exercise the ultimate answer to America's obesity epidemic? And actually, I'd submit to you, no, it's not the core issue. This was illustrated in an interview on a talk show with John McDougall and Carl Lewis. Now, who is Carl Lewis? Well, he was the fastest man on earth at the time. He set the record for the 100-yard dash. They were on a talk show. They were off stage. And John McDougall is an internist who's written best-selling books on how plant-based diet can reverse many of these degenerative diseases. And Carl Lewis said, you know, I have a problem with weight. If I eat too much, I gain weight. And Dr. McDougall says, you have a problem with weight? No one exercises more than you do. He says, yeah, no, I have a problem with weight. And then McDougall explains. He says, well, actually, anybody on the American diet will have a problem with weight no matter how much they exercise. He says, if you go on a plant-based diet, eliminate the free oils, you'll be able to eat as much as you want and won't gain the weight. Well, a year later, Sports Magazine interviewed Carl Lewis, and he said, a year ago, I went on a vegan diet. I had 2 things happen. I had the best year of performance ever, and we explained why yesterday. And I can eat as much as I want at meals, and I don't gain the weight. We had an intensivist in the hospital I was working at, and he got real upset because there was this pulmonologist who had come through the hospital would provide these buffet meals in the doctor's lounge, and this pulmonologist would go through and he would pile his plate with all these plant foods once and twice, and he was just this beanpole of a guy. And this intensivist got so angry, he says, "How can he do that? How can he do that? I struggle with just one plate, and I have trouble with weight." And so what I explained to him is what I'm going to explain to you. The core issue is for obesity in America is called insulin resistance. Now, we didn't have, normally you do a whole talk on diabetes, but I'm going to give it to you in a nutshell here. Diabetes type 2 is caused mainly by insulin resistance. What happens is when you take in a sugar or a starch, blood sugar goes up. The pancreas responds by releasing insulin. Insulin's a little key which goes to the cell doors and opens the cell doors and allows sugar to leave the blood and go in the cell and gets burned, and that brings your sugar down. And that's the normal response. That's what's supposed to happen. When you're on a high-fat diet, meat and dairy, and particularly the free oils, olive oil even, or peanut oil, any of these free oils, those fats will go in and they'll plug up the keyholes. Now when you take a sugar or a starch, your blood sugar goes up. The pancreas says, "Oh, blood sugar's up, I better release insulin." Releases insulin, which is a key. The key goes to those keyholes, but it's having trouble getting in the keyholes. So blood sugars will tend to start rising as we continue on the American diet with the high-fat foods. Well, the pancreas normally releases 30 units a day of insulin. And it starts thinking, you know, the normal 30 units of insulin I'm releasing every day, it's not working anymore. What am I going to do? He thinks about it for a minute. He says, "Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll release more insulin." So he releases 40 units a day instead of 30. And it does that for a while. And then as insulin resistance increases, he might go to 50 units a day or 60. So the insulin levels, actually it takes about 12 years for the pancreas to max out its capability. As insulin resistance continues to increase, and on the American diet it does for over about 12 years, at the end of 12 years, your pancreas is producing as much insulin as it can, but now it can't keep up anymore, and now the blood sugars rise, and now you're diagnosed with diabetes. But the process has been going on, they've documented, for about 12 years. As that insulin resistance rises, your insulin levels are rising because the pancreas is overcoming that resistance. The problem with this rising insulin is that insulin drives fat into fat cells and prevents fat from being burned. So as your insulin levels rise, what's going to happen to the weight? It's going to go up. It's a hormonal thing. It's generated by this insulin resistance, the type of foods we're eating. So let me give you some evidence here. Does insulin actually cause an increase in weight? I mean, do we see that clinically? Well, one of the first evidences we had was from what they call sulfonylureas. These were the first drugs used to treat diabetes. These drugs stimulate the pancreas to release more insulin. And it's commonly known, well, it says, this is from up-to-date medical reference, insulin stimulates weight gain, and sulfonylureas that increase insulin release also increase weight. Yeah, that's true. So there's another study done. They were treating diabetics, and they were treating some with basically a low-calorie diet, and others with these sulfonylurea drugs, and another with insulin injections. And then they looked at how each of these approaches affected their insulin levels, and they found the diet didn't affect their insulin levels at all, but that was not a vegan diet, it was a low-calorie diet. And because of that, there was no significant change in their weight. But the clopropamide and the glibenclamide, these are sulfonylureas, they increased the insulin levels, and there was a corresponding increase in weight. And finally, the insulin injections increased the insulin levels the most, and we had, again, a significant weight increase with that insulin level. Patients know this, actually, diabetic patients. We had one patient come in. I said, I'm sorry, but you're not doing this lifestyle approach, and your blood sugars continue to rise. We need to increase your insulin levels. He goes, oh, don't do that. I said, well, why not? He says, my weight will go up. He knew that whenever he increased his insulin, his weight would start to climb. So the diabetic control and complications trial found the same thing. What they did was, when we're treating diabetics, they say, well, why treat them with insulin at all? What's the point? Well, the point is, when you have high blood sugars, it can cause retinopathy, leads to blindness, cause nephropathy, leads to kidney failure, cause neuropathy, damage to the nerves. And they thought, hey, if we use high doses of insulin and keep the blood sugars even lower, maybe we can postpone these complications. So they gave one group a low-dose insulin, and they gave one group a high-dose insulin, and they found that, yes, the higher-dose insulin postponed damage to the eyes, the kidneys, and the nerves, but it came with a price. On the low-dose insulin, they gained 5 pounds. On the high-dose insulin, they gained 11 pounds. And that was the problem. Now, they looked at it and they say, well, maybe the people on the high-dose insulin, maybe they're eating more calories or maybe they're exercising less. When they looked individually at the weight gain from these people, they tried to correlate it with calorie intake. There was no correlation. High calorie, low calorie intake did not correlate with their weight gain. They looked at exercise, high exercise, low exercise. There was no correlation in this study with weight gain. It was all based on their insulin dose. When they looked at insulin dose, the higher the insulin dose, the more the weight gain. Well, what else besides insulin resistance can cause higher insulin levels? High glycemic index foods can. What's a high glycemic index food? It's a food that when you take, say, 100 calories, well, let's say you take 100 calories of apples, the apples can slow the release of sugar into your bloodstream, and you get a slow release. That would be a lower glycemic index. But if you take the apple juice and drink it, you're going to get a sugar spike. It's almost like injecting in sugar into your bloodstream. You get a sugar spike, and your body overreacts. It releases a lot of insulin. The pancreas says, oh, I'm panic. Releases a lot of insulin. You get an insulin spike, and in about an hour and a half to 2 hours, the blood sugar drops too low, and you get hungry and you want to eat again. Well, these insulin spikes, if you do it frequently, those insulin spikes will increase your average insulin levels, just like insulin resistance would. And when you have that higher insulin level, you're going to gain the weight as well. We had a friend of ours, he lost 14 pounds by just giving up soda pop, because he was getting rid of those insulin spikes. He wasn't reducing his calories, he was just changing how he got, the form his calories came in, from the high glycemic index foods to lower glycemic index foods. Is insulin resistance causing our epidemic? Well, yeah, it's prevalent enough to account for the epidemic we have. Can we reverse insulin resistance? And when we do the diabetic talk, we talk about the foods that reduce it. And if you see on the top there, the plant foods will lower your insulin resistance. The meat, the dairy, and I should put a picture in there of free oils, fried foods, salad oils, will also cause an increase in insulin resistance. So if insulin resistance is the main cause of obesity in America, we would expect that the foods which lower insulin resistance are going to produce the lowest weight people. Is that what we find in clinically? Well, the EPIC Oxford study was a study to determine that. They looked at, it's a huge study, they looked at 37,875 healthy men and women aged 20 to 97, and they put them into four groups. Meat eaters, fish eaters, vegetarians, and vegans. The blue graphs on the right, the group on the right is men, the group on the left is women. The blue graph shows their body mass index, and the blue group has the highest body mass index, and these are the omnivores, the meat eaters. Then they looked at the group that had eliminated the red meats and the poultry, but they continued to eat fish. Those were the fish eaters, and that's the red group you see, and that did lower the body mass index. Well, then they said, okay, let's look at the people that have also eliminated fish but continue to eat dairy products. That did not lower the weight anymore, not significantly. Then they looked at the group that, in addition to eliminating the fish, they also eliminated the dairy. And that was the vegans, and those are the green on the right, and that produced the lowest body mass index. And it turns out the vegan diet is the one that will lower your insulin resistance the most. And this is a medical journal explaining this effect and saying, yes, if you can lower the insulin levels through diet, you can lower weight. Apologize for the picture here. My wife says I need another picture of vegetarian foods because they actually look much better than this picture. But does a vegetarian diet work to lower weight dramatically? Well, it does, but is it easy to stay on? They did a study comparing a vegetarian diet and the typical low-calorie diet. And for 428 college students surveyed, if they did a low-calorie diet, they lasted about 3 months, 1 to 3 months. If they did a vegetarian diet, easily they tolerated easily over a year. And lastly, we want to look at the Grand Prix of epidemiological studies. This is the China study. It's the largest study ever done to date, showing the relationship between lifestyle and health outcomes. The New York Times described it as, quote, the most comprehensive large study ever undertaken of the relationship between diet and the risk of developing disease. And it says the findings are challenging much of American dietary dogma. What is the dietary dogma? It's challenging. It's challenging the concept that we're obese because we either have too many calories or too few exercise, too little exercise. It's challenging that. And what they did is they ranked the Chinese into five groups according to their levels of physical activity. After figuring out the calorie intake of the least active Chinese, the equivalent of an American office worker, we then compared the calorie intake of the average American to the average American. What we found was astonishing. What was astonishing? Well, here's what they did. In the, on the right, the graph, the bar on the right, it's olive green. That's the normalized weight for an American office worker. And on the right, you see the normalized weight for the Chinese. It's about 20% less. This is based on body mass index. So they said, well, okay, if they're both office workers, neither of them are getting any exercise, the activity level's the same, the only way we could explain this with American dietary dogma is they must be starving them. So let's document that. We'll measure the calories the Chinese are eating and show that they're eating less calories. And what we found was astonishing. The Chinese were actually eating more calories. They ate 30% more calories and weighed 20% less. How could this be? Well, they looked at what they were eating. And this is where we find that what the Chinese were eating were foods that would lower their insulin resistance. What the Americans were eating were foods that would increase their insulin resistance. Here's what they found. They had a, here's China, total calories. Sure enough, 2,600 calories a day, whereas the United States office worker, about 1,900 calories per day. Total fat, as a percent of calories, Chinese were only 14% of the calories from fat. Americans twice that, over twice that, 34 to 38% calories from fat. Dietary fiber, this is a marker of how much of their food came from plant products. They were getting 33 grams per day in China. America, only 12. Americans were eating one-third the amount of plants that the Chinese were eating. Total percent of calories from animal protein was for China was only 0.8. They were eating very little animal products, but in America, 10 to 11% of the calories came from animal proteins. Americans were eating more than 10 times as much animal protein compared to the Chinese. So how can I eat more and weigh less? Do I have to move to China? Okay, you heard about the story of a man who read that 50% of all car accidents occur within a 30-mile radius of home. So he moved. Okay, the good news is you have to process that, okay? The good news is you don't have to move to China to eat 30% more calories and weigh 20% less. The big thing is to try a vegan diet without free oils. That will lower your insulin resistance the most. Avoid the high glycemic index foods that cause that insulin spikes. Get a brisk walk, 30 to 90 minutes a day, if you can do that, or a little bit shorter breath while you're walking. And get a light or even skip the evening meal. Get most of your calories in the morning. Those are the big four.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.